The clock. Time for the news, read by Jane Royce.
The Health Ministry in Gaza says at least 87 people have been killed and more than 40 injured by Israeli strikes in the city of Beit Lahia in the north of the territory. Israel disputes the figure. The UN's humanitarian chief earlier said residents there were enduring unspeakable horrors. On the northern front, the Israeli military says its warplanes have hit Hezbollah's intelligence headquarters and an underground weapons workshop in Lebanon's capital, Beirut. It's the second time Israel has attacked Lebanon since a drone targeted Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's home yesterday. The Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, says he wants the NHS in England to become a neighbourhood health service. Under the plans, patients will be able to see GPs, district nurses, care workers and other medical professionals in the same building. Mr. Streeting has also said he wants to see the NHS benefit from cutting-edge technology by giving patients wearable gadgets such as smartwatches to help monitor their health. Voting's taking place in Moldova in a presidential election and a referendum on joining the European Union. The incumbent, Maia Sandu, is seeking a second term and has repeatedly raised concerns about Russian interference. Moscow has rejected her allegations. The Olympic cycling champion Sir Chris Hoy has revealed he has terminal cancer and has between 2 to 4 years left to live. The 48-year-old said he'd been diagnosed with primary cancer in his prostate, which had spread to his bones, meaning it was stage four. Sir Mark Cavendish is among those to have sent messages of support, describing his fellow cyclist as a hero of a human being. The King and Queen have attended a church service for their first official engagement of their Australia tour. There was a demonstration outside St Thomas Anglican Church by anti-monarchy protesters and those calling for more rights for Indigenous communities. Weather warnings are in place across large parts of the UK as Storm Ashley hits. A yellow alert for high winds gusting up to 60 miles an hour covers the whole of Scotland, as well as parts of Northern Ireland and Wales, until midnight. Elsewhere, heavy rain will move eastwards across the UK, clearing to leave sunny spells and showers in the northwest. BBC News and weather at 2 minutes past 12. Now it's time for Private Passions with Michael Barclay. The programme contains strong discriminatory language.
The American writer Garth Greenwell won widespread acclaim for his first novel, What Belongs to You, including the British Book Award for the debut of the year. The success would have surprised his high school teachers in Kentucky. As a teenager, he failed English and decided to follow a very different path. He turned to singing and eventually trained as an opera singer. Studying music led him back to literature, writing poems, novels, and working as a teacher in Bulgaria. Garth's latest novel, Small Rain, is about a near-death medical emergency and provokes deep meditations on vulnerability, life and love. And you've brought us music, Garth, which echoes those thoughts, I think. We've got a wonderful selection, Britten, Strauss, Beethoven. But we're starting with John Taverner, the 16th century John Taverner.
That's right, yes. The Gloria from the Western Wind Mass.
What is it about this music that attracts you?
So this is one of the first pieces of art that appears in this new novel, Small Rain. And it's really the poem, the Western Wind poem, which is a poem that I encountered very early singing the Taverner Mass and then also taught for years as a high school teacher.
Which line were you singing when you were doing it?
I was a tenor. Hmm. Yeah.
Even though it's polyphony, there are little odd turns, aren't there?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And that's something I love about early music, the fact that there's a kind of harmony, the function of which you recognize. And as you say, there are all of these surprises. Things don't move quite as one suspects. And that the seed of it is just the simplest idea. And yet from that, this marvelous complexity unfurls. And that's something that I find very attractive, taking a small idea and sort of seeing everything one can build from it.
Thank you. The Gloria from the Western Wind Mass, composed by John Tavner and performed by the Yale Schola Cantorum, conducted by Simon Carrington. I saw you smiling towards the end of that, Garth. You get to the end of a phrase which the ear leads one to think will be a minor chord, and suddenly it's a major, bright
That's right.
and blaring.
One is headed toward an inevitable conclusion, and then all of a sudden, something surprising happens.
Well, that comes in your books a lot, I think.
Well, and also this sense of a confusion of major and minor, thinking about that as a kind of emotional palette. Emotions are complex things. What makes a feeling profound is the sense that sort of within it, if one dives deep enough, one finds the opposite. You know, in sadness, one finds joy. In joy, one finds sadness.
Tell us a little bit about your early life in rural Kentucky.
So I had a very split childhood. My family were tobacco farmers. I was the first generation raised off the farm. And so my life was split between Louisville, which is a city where I went to school, and then the family farm, which was where we spent almost all our weekends and vacations.
And this was Twister country, wasn't it?
Absolutely. I grew up in tornado country. That's right. I remember my grandmother yelling at me to come inside because I always wanted to be outside in these dangerous thunderstorms.
And you were quite close to your grandmother.
That's right. I was close to my grandmother and I was also close to my great-grandmother. They all lived together on the farm. And I remember, you know, my great-grandmother was this extraordinary woman who in her 80s was still pushing her little lawnmower up her hill. She taught me to crochet. And we used to sit together. And in some way, I wonder if my great-grandmother teaching me to crochet and spending those long afternoons with me in front of the television, I wonder if she was trying to sort of make a place in this world for this boy who clearly did not fit in. It was not at all a cultural household. As you mentioned in your introduction, my teachers despaired of me. I failed the first semester of freshman English. In part, I failed because I was a terrible student and just kind of completely lost, had no sense what I wanted to do with my life. But I also failed because when I was 14, my father discovered I was gay and kicked me out of the house towards the end of the semester. And I simply just could not finish my work. My father said to me, "If it's true that you're gay, you're not welcome in my house. And if I had known you would be a faggot, you would never have been born."
Pretty devastating to hear that as a child.
I mean, you know, it's a violation of the primordial contract, which is the idea that someone willed you to be, that you exist because your parents wanted you to exist. And yes, I think as a 14-year-old to hear my father say, "I wish I could cancel out your existence," that was a devastating thing. But again, thinking of surprising transformations, it was because of that and because I needed extra credits in order to graduate on time that I enrolled in the school choir. And it turned out that somehow in this Kentucky public school, there was a very brilliant singer and a very generous educator directing that choir, a man named David Brown, who heard something in my voice, started giving me voice lessons after school, and gave me my first opera CDs and also my first tickets to the opera. And opera felt to me like the opposite of Kentucky. you know, now that is not true. And, you know, in my sense of Kentucky is much more complicated now than it was when I was a kid. I mean, growing up as a gay kid in Kentucky, I felt that nothing about me fit into the world. Everything about me was too big. My feelings were too big. My body was too big. My gestures were too big. You know, there is a model of Southern, maybe especially rural Southern masculinity that is all about control, containment, leanness. I was none of those things. And when I heard opera, what I heard was the promise of a world where I might fit, a promise of a world where the scale of my feelings made sense. And it was through opera and through singing art song that I discovered poetry.
Well, your first opera is, in fact, all about the strangeness, the mystery, the beauty of childhood, isn't it?
That's right. So this teacher in Kentucky, David Brown, gave me tickets to the Kentucky Opera. And the first opera I saw was Così fan tutte, which now I love, but when I was 14 did not make much of an impression. But my second opera was Benjamin Britten's Turn of the Screw. And that introduced me to Britten, who would become a lifelong obsession. And it also introduced me to Henry James, who is now probably the most important English language writer for me.
Well, it's a ghost story, really, isn't it? Turn of the Screw.
That's right. The way that it opens with just bare piano and a single voice speaking to us, creating or opening a door to the world of the story, I feel like that is a kind of sense of narration that I've been chasing in all of my novels. But also the way in which then, as we move into The Governess, Britten's music is doing so much at once. It's evoking the external world, so we hear the train, but also the music is psychology. We hear the governess's anxiety. We hear her fortitude and her resolve. We hear an incredible vulnerability. And what Britten does in the instruments, in the orchestra, what he does, you know, I think that that for me is an ideal of what sentences can do. There is a way in which when one is writing well, you know, the shape of one's sentences, as much as anything the sentences say, provide that sense of psychology. And that's something, I mean, again, I could never have articulated that as a 14-year-old, but it's something that I first learned then.
You say orchestra, and of course the other magic of this is that actually it's only 13 instruments.
That's right.
But what he does with them, and for example, the percussion is like a pulse, isn't it, running
yes.
through, which can be ominous, maybe not, but you don't know, that's the whole point.
I love the way that you get this sense that he is using kind of minimal means, but he's getting maximal effect from them. And this is also true in Henry James. You know, Henry James will take a very simple situation, a very small cast, like in Turn of the Screw. It's a governess, two children, a maid. But he wrings every bit of possible meaning and drama out of that. And that I love.
Microclimates of feeling, you described.
That's exactly right. Microclimates of feeling. And you just squeeze it. You get everything you can out of it.
It is a curious story. I have it written in faded ink. A woman's hand, governess to two children long ago. Untried, innocent, she had gone first to see their guardian in London. A young man, bold, offhand, and gay, the children's only relative. The children were in the country with an old housekeeper. There had been a governess, but she had gone. The boy, of course, was at school, but there was the girl, and the holidays now begun. This, then, would be her task, but there was one condition. He was so much engaged. Affairs, travel, friends, visits. Always something, no time at all for the poor little things. She was to do everything, be responsible for everything, not to worry him at all, no. Not to write, but to be silent and do her best. She was full of doubts, but she was carried away that he, so gallant and handsome, so deep in the busy world, should need her help. At last, I will, she said.
in store for me. Oh, will greet me the children, will they be clever, will they like me?
We heard the opening and prologue of The Turn of the Screw, the story by Henry James, in the opera that was written by Benjamin Britten, who directed that performance with Peter Pierce, Jennifer Vivian, and the English opera group Orchestra. I think also the relationship between Pierce and Britten probably fascinated you.
It was crucial for me. The fact that Britten wrote so much of his music for his partner, the fact that that music then became a kind of stage on which they could publicly celebrate their love in a climate where homosexuality was still criminalized. And also Pierce as a singer as well became such an important sort of aesthetic touchstone for me because, you know, it's such a strange voice. And there are ways in which it is not a conventionally attractive voice.
Yes, well, Dudley Moore took it off in a famous...
It's an incredible, yes, absolutely, an incredible sketch, which I think Benjamin Britten was extremely unhappy about.
But you see, you say, as with your childhood, that these were times when homosexuality was illegal. But more than that, Britten himself was quite a conventional figure in many ways. So he was fighting himself.
That's right. And I remember reading how upset he would get when Pierce would put on drag or things or be sort of more flamboyant than he was. And yet, I came to see the music that Britten wrote for Pierce as this kind of ideal embodiment of what love could be. Because, you know, Britten wrote music for this very unconventional instrument, Pierce's voice. He wrote music that at once catered to that voice, understood the limitations of that voice, and as a kind of act of care, took care of those limitations, but also challenged Pierce. And that, I think, it's the model of love that Plato presents in the Phaedrus, where he says that what the lover does is constantly show up to the beloved, their ideal face, you know, to sort of present an image, to challenge the beloved to be their best self. And that's what I hear in Britten's music. It seems to me just an extraordinary act of love. And, you know, Pierce would never have been the artist he was without
Britten. No, he was a sort of choral scholar type.
Exactly
singer.
Right. Yeah. And yet he became, I think, well, sometimes I have arguments with people about this. I think Pierce is one of the great singers of the 20th century because the limitations of his instrument forced every bit of artistry of which he was capable.
You mentioned that your father threw you out, furious when he discovered that you were gay. What about your schoolmates? How did they react to that?
Well, not very well. I remember in the week after I came out, all of a sudden, the boy who had the locker next to mine, so I would see him open his locker door multiple times a day, he put up a very popular sticker on the inside of his locker that said, AIDS kills, fags dead. And I remember in math class, there was a boy on the football team who sat behind me, and the entire class, he would say, just loudly enough for me to hear, he would say, faggot, and repeat it again and again. Neither of us did well in that class. No, it was a very difficult place. And, you know, I think having spent 7 years as a high school teacher and four of them in Bulgaria, where I had many students come to me because I was the only openly gay person almost any of my students had ever met in real life. I had many students come to me and say that they wanted to come out, that they wanted to live a more authentic life. And we would have very difficult conversations about whether that was a safe choice for them. I didn't have anyone with whom to have those conversations. I think it was probably not a great idea to come out when I was 14, and it made for a very difficult couple of years.
Music next, it's Beethoven. What have you chosen?
So this is the second movement of the final sonata, the sonata number 32, and it's performed by Alfred Brendel.
Thank you.
The second movement of Beethoven's Piano Sonata No. 32 in C, performed by Alfred Brendel. And he does bring something special to the music, doesn't he? Some kind of inner vision.
He's so virtuosic. He can play anything faster than anybody else, and yet he's also so thoughtful.
Humble.
And that's very rare. And yes, that sense of humility to the music, I mean, that's very rare. I often think that virtuosity gets in the way of artistry. Sometimes, you know, you feel that if someone can just do anything, nothing feels hard won. And yet you hear in Brendel's performance of this movement, this simple material that is then elaborated and elaborated to the point of getting lost. You know, you have gone very far from home. Brendel makes you feel that lostness and then also makes you feel that sort of profound sensation of homecoming at the end of the movement. And that, yeah, that's something that I hear in his playing more than anyone else's.
You went on, Garth Greenwell, to study voice at the Eastman School of Music in New York. Was that a happy time for you?
Oh, it absolutely was a revolution in my life. I mean, to suddenly be in a place with absolutely brilliant musicians, but just with in a place where everyone's life was oriented to art. I mean, that was just like someone flipped a switch, and not just in music, but also I had these wonderful literature and history teachers who modeled a passionate life of the mind. And that woke something up in me. And it was why I wanted to be a high school teacher later in life, because I experienced so profoundly how high school teachers can really save young people.
Alongside the music, you had the opportunity to do extra classes in poetry.
With a wonderful poet and scholar who just a couple of years ago passed away far too early, a man named James Langenbach. And that too was a kind of revelation. You know, he modeled what a life devoted to poetry looked like. He was a kind of priest of poetry and made me feel that that would be the noblest possible life.
There's something about the music you've chosen so far, and indeed, I think one could apply this to poetry, is that great works of art in those two mediums are economic, that less is more.
I feel that, but also that less is more in a literal sense, that sort of you can take these simple ideas and work them and rework them until they become something. Like, you know, by the time we reach the third variation in that movement of the Beethoven, we have arrived somewhere incredibly complex. It doesn't feel minimal. It feels maximal. And it also feels as though somehow Beethoven, and this is something I feel about much great art, lots of art carries with it a sense of its pastness, and that is part of what is precious about it. But sometimes great art, you feel that somehow it has stepped out of time. In that third variation in the Beethoven, it's like Beethoven invents swing 70 years or whatever before swing actually comes into existence. It's as though, you know, all of a sudden we're listening to a boogie-woogie, you know, in this extraordinary sonata. And that sense of this tiny idea that has been elaborated and somehow has catapulted us outside of historical time so that it feels absolutely modern. That, to me, is exhilarating about
Beethoven. These ideas are embryos, really, waiting to develop into a fully-fledged.
I think that's right, and that's exciting. When you hear that process, that's something that excites me.
Did you find that music training helped you with your writing?
Oh, there's no question. I mean, everything I am as a writer comes from having been a singer, including the shapes of my sentences, which absolutely, I think, come from having had a kind of bel canto training, a certain way of spinning out the breath. And then also, you know, very often operatic arias, and especially bel canto arias, very few words are extended over great expanses of time. Singing phrases like that, I think, was a kind of training in how stretching out words across time, stretching out meaning across time, is a way of generating emotion. And, you know, I'm drawn to long sentences, and I think that that is one reason why.
Well, you couldn't do better, Garth, than have Richard Strauss next in that case. Somebody who spreads out a line so expansively.
This piece, so Jesse Norman's recording of Strauss's Four Last Songs, was my inner emotional landscape when I was 15 and 16. I listened to this disc again and again and again. And this was for me the sound of rapture.
the tenderness that she manages to bring to some of those phrases and float them.
It's just extraordinary. You know, when I am writing, I never think about other writers, but I do sometimes feel like that there's a shape I'm trying to fill. And when I feel that, very often I am thinking of Jesse Norman singing the four last songs. There is a way in which it is an ideal of artistic shape, the way she shapes a phrase. No one else does it. And the fact that this song, which is about the dying of the year, you know, the sort of the end of something, it's something she brings to it, you know, with this incredible voice that has kind of mezzo coloring, but also has access to this crystalline pianissimo high singing above the staff. There is this grand negation, the negation of death, the negation of the dying of the year. And yet in it is some kind of affirmation. The way that she sings it becomes one of my earliest experiences of rapture. And that, I think, is an aesthetic ideal I've been chasing ever since.
September, from The Four Last Songs by Strauss, performed by Jesse Norman, and the Leipzig Gewandhaus Orchestra, conducted by Kurt Mazur. Garth Greenwell, you went to Harvard to do an MA in English and American Literature, started writing poetry regularly, and then began teaching.
That's right. You know, this was really, to me, the most consequential decision I ever made, which was to drop out of the PhD program at Harvard. You know, at a certain point, I realized that I needed, and this is not true for everyone, but that I had to make a choice between being a scholar and an artist. When I realized that, then the choice was very easy for me. But it was a difficult choice for everyone else in my life.
Yes, it's a financial choice to start off with.
To leave what looked like a sure path to becoming a professor, to having a certain kind of life as a literary person. And yet, it was when I left that path and became a high school teacher, first in Ann Arbor and then in Bulgaria, that I began my real education as a writer.
In 2009, you moved to Sofia.
Which, again, was this sort of incomprehensible leap to everyone in my life to sort of take this job. I had never even had a passport until my first year teaching high school when I chaperoned a group of kids to France. I wanted to be abroad, and so I was looking for a job in Europe.
And when you got there, what did you find? Did you have to learn Bulgarian?
I did learn Bulgarian, which, you know, you really don't have to do in Sofia. But I love languages. I can't imagine living somewhere without learning the language. And it became very important for me to know the language because it meant that I could know people, have relationships with people who didn't have access to English.
What belongs to you is set in Bulgaria. And I wonder how you made that transition. What made you abandon, well, not abandon, but move from poetry in favor of writing a novel?
It's very mysterious to me. But for some reason, I had finished a manuscript of poems. I had put it away to let it sit for a while. And I started feeling sentences that I knew were not broken into lines. It was very confusing to me. I never thought of writing the book as writing a novel until it was very nearly finished. I thought of it every morning. I got up at 4:30. I worked for 2 hours before going in to teach a day of classes. And I thought of that time as writing sentences.
The book is narrated by an expat teacher who develops an obsession with the young Bulgarian man called Mitko. He's smitten from the minute he lays eyes on him, but it's unrequited.
It's certainly asymmetrical. You know, they meet in this cruising bathroom beneath the National Palace of Culture, and the narrator pays this man for sex. And this begins what will be a 2 or 3 year long relationship between them. And that relationship is never a conventional love relationship. But I do think the novel is a kind of love story. And even if their relationship is, you know, structured and formed and deformed by this transaction with which it begins, there are moments between them that, as I experience them, exceed the terms of that transaction. And there are moments of sort of possibility and feeling between them that, to me, the only appropriate word for them is something like love.
It's a very moving book, and it was a huge success. Recently, it's been made into an opera, and we can hear an excerpt from it. How is it that we can hear what I think will be a first broadcast performance of part of it?
That's right. So this is just one of the really joyful things that has happened to me. It feels like coming full circle to have my first novel made into an opera. And yes, this is a recording from a workshop performance. Mitko arrives at the apartment and is banging on the door, and he wakes the narrator up. And as he's waking, the narrator remembers having lived through an earthquake in Sofia. And so as he wakes up, he thinks that that's what's happening.
That spring, sleeping deeply one night in a state beneath dreams, I bolted awake like weeks earlier, pinned to my bed by an animal fear, in the strongest earthquake to strike Bulgaria century. But rousing me now was not that deep grinding thunder, but a banging, a banging, a banging, a banging on my door. And of course, Mitko came in, not stepping, but stumbling. His eyes rolling eerily around, around in his head. A posture of agony. A posture of agony. Taken something too. He looked terrible, still thinner, so that the clothes he wore tight hung loose on his frame, and his skin of color made me pull. I held him in my arms.
Enormously atmospheric and rather like the Britain, great use of percussion, particularly the vibraphone.
You know, I find it just overwhelming to hear that. Words, sentences that I wrote, I mean, 14 years ago now, brought to life in this new medium. But also the way that David T. Little, the composer, and Karim Suleiman, the singer, access just this absolute of emotion and this absolute existential situation where this man the narrator has loved returns to him, and together they have to confront this man's death. Mitko has become very, very sick. And there is something so, again, it's this paradoxical way in which that music feels to me so stark and yet also so utterly sort of saturated with feeling. And so hearing it, I mean, I just feel undone by it.
An excerpt from Earthquake, derived from What Belongs to You, composed by David T. Little and performed there very persuasively by the tenor Karim Suleiman, and Alarm Will Sound, conducted by Alan Pearson. This idea of being in a vulnerable state, being, as you say, I'm nothing, disappearing into smoke, are those things that occupy you quite a lot yourself anyway?
So all of my books in some ways have been exploring shame. And people like to talk about that when they talk about my books, but often the way they talk about it feels very alienating to me. Sometimes people talk about shame in my first two books as though the shame is about sort of being gay. And it's true that that was a lesson the narrator was taught about his life, but it's also true that the narrator has rejected that lesson. The shame in those books, I think, is really about desire itself, because desire is something that happens to us and that strips us of our will. And that is an experience of shame, an experience of humiliation, or it can be, the sense that one's life is governed by this force against which one has such little recourse. And then in the new book, Small Rain, I think the shame is about being an organic being whose only destiny can be to die. You know, the book begins with this narrator being struck down by an annihilating pain. And it turns out that he has this potentially fatal condition, a tear in his aorta. And that too, I mean, both of these are ways in which a truth of existence is imposed upon him, which is one, our utter vulnerability to the contingency of existence. And the other one is our utter dependence on others.
And but also being stripped of kind of dignity. This character is lying in a hospital and relying entirely on people to perform most bodily functions.
Well, and you know, and this is a narrator who cares about art and poetry and music, who likes to think about philosophy and theology. And the fact that all of that, that everything we are, everything that gives our lives meaning, love, music, poetry, that all of that depends on things like, are his bowels functioning? You know, that is humiliating, that these sort of grand metaphysical constructs depend upon this machine of the body, any part of which might fail.
I wonder, did you undergo anything as serious as that aortic tear?
Yes, the book is not autobiography, it's not memoir, but it is true that I often find that I need to write a book when I feel utterly bewildered by something that has happened to me or happened in my immediate vicinity that I've witnessed. And I underwent a medical crisis in summer 2020, similar to that the narrator undergoes. In my early 40s, having always been basically healthy, I was told that I could die. And so having to ask these questions, if this is it at 42, 43, what has it all been worth? What has it all meant? The bewilderment of that is why I needed to write the book.
I think this next music, Julius Eastman, is a current obsession.
Yes, Julius Eastman grew up in Ithaca, New York. He was a black gay man, and as such was a rarity in the world of classical music of the time. He became involved with a group of experimental American composers, including Morton Feldman. He also had a very famous interaction with John Cage, where he enraged John Cage in a performance of the Songbooks by sort of giving a very flamboyantly gay interpretation of one of Cage's instructions in that. And he had real success as a musician. He was a singer as well as a composer. And in fact, you know, my first encounter with him, although I didn't know who he was, he performed on the Blaise recording of Peter Maxwell Davis's Eight Songs for a Mad King. He is the singer on that recording. It's an extraordinary performance. But he became more and more uncomfortable and felt more and more unwelcome in the world of classical music. And after this initial very promising youth, he really fell away and had a very difficult, very sort of tragic later life. He died in, I think, 1990 at the age of 50 after experiencing homelessness, mental illness, likely drug addiction. And there have always been questions about whether the cause of his death was AIDS. The family has very strongly denied that. But, you know, it's this heartbreaking story of someone the world could not accommodate, this brilliant black queer musician. And in recent years, there has been a real effort to recover the music that he made, much of which was, you know, in this intermediate space between notated music and improvised music. And there were a lot of jazz elements in his composition. And we're going to hear a few minutes from an improvised hour-long concert he did that's known as the Zurich Concert.
Thank you.
It's incredibly powerful, that music, sort of waves of turbulence coming at you.
And again, you know, this kind of thread through a lot of the music today, it is this tiny idea, you know, these jangling chords in the piano. And it's as though that idea becomes a question that he is asking again and again and again. And like in the Beethoven, getting further and further away from this initial small idea into this world of an incredible complexity. And it becomes to me, I mean, very dramatic and exciting. Will he find a way back? You know, will there be an answer to this question? But this is what thinking sounds like in music. And I find that so inspiring as a writer, because I want to find a way to get that sound, that feeling, that sort of muscular thinking into prose, into sentences.
I really liked it. An excerpt from the Zurich concert composed and performed by Julius Eastman. Garth Greenwell, your books so much depend on the exploration of relationships, the desire to be free, but at the same time, the yearning for permanence and stability, something you struggle with yourself.
Well, you know, I think this is one of the sort of central dilemmas of human life, that the very commitments that give our life meaning, give our life value, also limit us. They are also limitations on our freedom. And my narrator is someone who has been attached to an idea of his life as a life of adventure, you know, geographical adventures in Eastern Europe, and certainly erotic adventure. And now in this novel, he finds himself 7 years into a long-term relationship, sharing a mortgage on a house in the American heartland in Iowa, and that in a certain way feels to him like the opposite of adventure. But what I hope the book explores in this annihilating pain, that world that maybe he has come to take for granted is taken away from him. And paradoxically, by taking that world, that life away from him, the pain delivers it back to him. Because when he's in this ICU bed, all he can think about is how precious this life that has been taken from him is, how desperate he is to get back to it. He discovers that, in fact, being in a long love with someone, being in this intimacy day after day with someone, that too is an adventure.
And the way that something outside can cast so much light, I'm thinking of the sparrow.
Yes, these sort of very everyday things light up with meaning in the face of mortality. So the narrator becomes obsessed. The only living creature he can see from the outside world is a sparrow outside his window, and that sparrow becomes unbelievably precious to him.
That couldn't be a better lead into our next music, even if we had tried to think of it, which is, of course, one of the great moments in music performed by one of the great singers.
You know, it's hard for me to talk about how important this piece has been for me. This is one of the Rückertlieder performed by Kathleen Ferrier. Ich bin der Welt abhanden gekommen. I am lost to the world. You know, hearing this piece when I was very young, I felt like it created some new aspect of being a human being for me. It created some new feeling, a kind of humanization that art can be for us.
It could be another last song, couldn't it, really?
It is a song about death, yes. It's a song about a certain kind of death to the world and a certain kind of isolation.
Thank you. It's so achingly beautiful, it's almost hard to listen to, isn't it? In a wonderful way that sad things actually make us feel joyous.
Well, that's exactly it. And, you know, there was this curious thing that happened very early in writing Small Rain, where this piece suddenly imposed itself. I had to talk about this moment where the narrator is in the ER. He's just arrived. He's being examined by a surgeon. And she's pressing into his abdomen in a way that causes him a lot of pain. And he's thinking about this moment, and he's thinking especially about these lines, Ich bin gestorben dem Weltgetümmel und ruhe in einem stillen Gebiet. I am dead to the world's tumult, you know, and rest in a quiet realm. And there's a moment when Ferrier sings und ruhe, where she's singing in A flat and there's a G in the violins, and it creates this thing we've been talking about through this whole program, which is this moment where there coexist major and minor.
Suspensions.
Exactly. But this moment that sort of troubles harmony. And I realized actually only recently that that's why this moment of music had to be at that moment in the narrative, because I had to have that sense where somehow sadness opens up to some kind of rapturous revelation, and that is caught in that extraordinary suspension, that moment of harmonic confusion.
Mahler's setting of Rückert, I Am Lost to the World, sung by Kathleen Ferrier and the Vienna Philharmonic, conducted by the wonderful Bruno Walter. The book's dedicated to your partner, the poet, Luis Muñoz. Do you feel that his presence informs the pages?
Oh, I think the book is more than anything else a story of love. And it is a book that I wrote for my partner. And in some sense, the whole book is a kind of love letter to him.
Your final piece.
So my final piece, another piece that was very important to me as a young person, returning to Benjamin Britten. This is the first canticle, My Beloved Is Mine, sung by Anthony Rolfe Johnson with Graham Johnson at the piano.
Again, Britten brings into focus that relationship between these two characters.
Well, and what's extraordinary, when he and Piers performed this piece, they were, in a way, absolutely forbidden by the world. They were declaring completely openly their love for one another.
Well, it only remains really for me to say thank you very much, Garth, for an extremely illuminating programme about your music and why you love it and how it informs your literature. Thank you.
Well, thank you. It has been a joy to be here today.
Yeah. Those glittering monarchs that command the servile quarters of this earthly ball should tender in exchange their shares of land, I would not change my fortunes for them all. Their wealth is but a counter to my coin. The world is but theirs, but mine. No chance, no death can bar my least desires, can bar my least desires unto the least remove. No time, no place, no chance, no death, no time, no place, no chance, no death can bar my least desires unto the least remove. He's firmly mine by oath, I his by vow. He's mine by faith, and I am his by love. He's mine by water, I am his by wine. Thus I, my best beloved, am. Thus he is mine. Thus he is mine.
Thank you. My Beloved Is Mine by Benjamin Britten, performed by Anthony Rolfe Johnson and Graham Johnson on the piano, the final choice of Michael Barclay's guest on Private Passions, the American writer Garth Greenwell. The programme was produced by Claire Walker, and next week Michael's going to be talking to the actor Brian Cox.
For a performer at the start of their career, the BBC Young Musician competition is a game changer. With previous finalists including Sheku Kanno Mason, Nicola Benedetti, and me, Jess Gillam.
Join me, Sarah Walker, for the electrifying conclusion to the 2024 contest. The BBC Young Musician Grand Final. This evening from 6:25.
Listen on Radio 3 and BBC Sounds.
This is Radio 3. We're at Blackburn Cathedral for Choral Evensong at 3. But now here's Sarah Moore-Peach with this week's edition of Music Map.
Hello and welcome to Radio 3's Music Map, where we plot a journey towards a piece of classical music through a landscape of connected sounds. Now tell me, what is the first piece of classical music you heard that really got you hooked? For the last decade or so, the BBC's 10 Pieces scheme has been offering young people, aged 7 to 14, a way in to classical music, each year choosing 10 pieces to inspire. And this year, to celebrate its 10th anniversary, the project has 10 pieces of music by female composers, from the radiant sonic visions of 12th century nun Hildegard of Bingen to the genre-busting avant-jazz of London bandleader Cassie Kinoshi. All music connects across time and space, as we find out on this programme. And today, in celebration of the new 10 pieces, we're going on a magical journey past several of them. We'll be travelling to the deep south of America and the civil rights movement in music by Margaret Bonds. We'll be sculling down the River Rhine to the strains of medieval plainsong and the romantic outpourings of Robert Schumann, and along the Thames in works by Handel and Erilyn Wallen. And at the very end of today's journey, we'll be setting sail on the North Sea in a thrilling concerto by the Scottish-based composer Sally Beamish. So let's begin our journey. In a few moments, we'll be dropping anchor at the first of today's destinations, Magical Music for Voices and Instruments by Judith Weir, based on Shakespeare's shipwrecked play The Tempest. It's from a piece called Storm. So let's begin with another British storm at sea by Benjamin Britten.